You're listening to a WOSU Public Media podcast. Everything you hear is funded by listeners like you. Become a member of WOSU Public Media today and support digital content like Snollygoster and the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast. Make a gift at WOSU.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Jeopardy host Alex Trebek was considered the consummate game show MC, smart, suave, and witty, and never one to overshadow the game itself. In a January interview, then executive producer Mike Richards spoke to CBS News about Trebek's final episode that aired 2 months after his death.
The man made being smart cool. And what a great legacy that is. And we've got to keep it going.
Let's go to work.
His DNA is in that show, in the way we run it, in the way we write it, in the way we cast it. It's everywhere, and we're not changing it.
So long, everybody. Take care.
Except that everything but the game itself sort of has changed. As its 38th season begins, Jeopardy fans still are reeling from a cattle call-style host selection process, which culminated with Richards himself being named the new host. Mere days later, executives changed their mind. We're going to talk about all that. Now the quiz show remains embroiled in the ensuing controversy. Julia Jacobs covers art and culture for the New York Times. She's been covering the Jeopardy story. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
So because the shows are taped in advance, audiences will see Mike Richards host a week of shows, but he's no longer the host or the executive producer. Can you give us a thumbnail of this chain of events?
Exactly. So fans are going to have a very bizarre week ahead of them. They're going to have Mike Richards as the face of Jeopardy after this absolute whirlwind of events. You know, you had him guest host back in February, but no one really expected him to be a contender. Then all of a sudden in August, he comes up in the news as being the head of the pack for taking over, and people are shocked. People don't really know who this guy is. Then, you know, he's named host, and only days later it comes out that he has said some offensive and inappropriate things in a podcast. Then he steps down as host. Only, you know, a week or so later, he steps down as executive producer. And yet, for 5 days, we're going to see the former decision in action with him as the host.
It's so bizarre. I mean, you wonder what they were thinking doing that. Have you gotten a handle on that?
Well, I think that's the question fans had. I mean, in this day and age, we're quite used to the pattern of someone being named for a major role in media, and then, you know, past comments being dug up through Twitter and the like. I mean, you expect that people in the vetting process will look back through episodes of a podcast that this person did years ago. I mean, the sense I have is that perhaps he was already considered vetted. When he was executive producer, he was in a major, major television role. But the reality is that people out there are going to give a lot more scrutiny to someone who's in front of the camera versus someone who's behind it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about Jeopardy, and we're talking about game shows writ large. And later on in the program, I know we have a big audience out there. I know some of you have been on game shows. If you could call in and share a story of your experience being on a game show, any game show, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I have a couple questions. How did Sony executives so badly hobble this process to replace Trebek? Because it started out with that cattle call sort of approach, and I didn't really understand what they were trying to get at.
Well, I think the approach there was, look, you know, Alex Trebek has been a fixture in Jeopardy, in the game show world, for 36 years. We clearly can't just bring in a new permanent host. I mean, this was Mike Richards himself. I spoke to him in January, and he told me that. He said, you know, people are not ready for a new permanent host, so we're going to do a sort of audition process where you have a bunch of people coming on and doing a couple of weeks of episodes that included people like LeVar Burton, like George Stephanopoulos. But there were a lot of people who clearly were not really in the running for that role. I mean, you have someone like Anderson Cooper, who's on CNN. He's pretty established. And then you have someone like Mike Richards. You have people like Ken Jennings and Buzzy Cohen, who clearly were gunning for the position. I mean, for fans, I think it was, you know, several months of whiplash. And now, I mean, that's exactly what we're going back to, because without a permanent host in Mike Richards, we're going to have another parade of guest hosts who are trying to essentially audition for the role.
And are they going to do any repeats? Any folks from the first round? Do you think they're going to be coming back or what?
All we know right now is Maim Bialik, who has been chosen as the host of the primetime Jeopardy specials. She is coming back as the first guest host. Other than that, we don't have much information on who the next guest hosts are going to be.
Does anyone know if Alex Trebek had a hand in deciding that cattle call process and going that route?
You know, I'm not sure. But what I do know is, you know, he had a couple of names that he had kind of thrown out in interviews in the past. But other than that, he never really made known who a successor was going to be. What we do know is he gave Ken Jennings a pair of cufflinks when he passed. He left them in the studio for Ken. And so we know he had some affection toward Ken, but we don't really know that he had a plan, a clear plan for succession.
When you saw the cavalcade of aspiring game show hosts come on, did you have any sense about a pattern there, what they were looking for?
You know, the people who guest hosted were so different that there really was no pattern. You know, you had Aaron Rodgers, who, you know, football player. You had Dr. Oz, who I think a lot of people were sort of confused by mm-hmm. by his role, because, you know, we know he was good friends with Alex, but we don't, you know, he's someone who I think we know to sort of peddle pseudoscience. And this is sort of a game show with such integrity in terms of the facts. There really wasn't a clear pattern other than you had a lot of television personalities. You had a lot of actors. You know, it seemed like a lot of big network people were brought in to just sort of get viewers. So, you know, here's Anderson Cooper doing Jeopardy, but not a clear line of people who were actually up for the job.
And did they ever establish any criteria for how they were going to choose that person? Did they ever share that with you, the media?
No, I mean, there was never a public sort of rubric for what the next Alex Trebek would look like. And so, you know, I think that's clearly part of why Mike Richards, you know, ended up getting the role himself. I mean, the process was, I think they wanted it to be transparent by putting all these people up for, you know, quote unquote auditions. Mm-hmm. But in the end, the process, I think, according to fans that I've talked to, really seemed to lack the transparency that they wanted in making this really critical decision.
You know, speaking of the fans, what do you think about this fan investment in this decision and in the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, this matters a lot to people, but what I keep hearing time and time again from fans who are just really obsessed with the game is like, they just want this whole crazy drama to be over. You know, you have this contestant who I believe is going on his 18th win, Matt Amodio. And so the fans I've talked to are more interested in talking about that and talking about the gameplay and are tired of the sort of drama that this process has brought to a show that they considered, you know, they thought it was impermeable to this sort of drama. And I think they're quite ready to move on. You know, the people who comment on social media and who talk about this issue, not all of them watch it as regularly as these fans who are ready to just talk about the gameplay again.
There was groundswell online for LeVar Burton. You know, I saw that very familiar name. What do you think went wrong there?
Well, I mean, LeVar himself was campaigning for it. He said
That's right.
You know, this would be a dream of his. This would be a culmination of his entire career. To see a black man in this role to him was so important. And what we know is that he was not given the same amount of time that the other guest hosts were. He essentially got a week of shows instead of 2 weeks, which his wife has said online, it seems to be a point of frustration for them. He also was, he was guest host during the Olympics. So when you look at the ratings, you know, you have people like Ken Jennings and Mike Richards toward the top, but LeVar doesn't make it even close. And I think it's obvious that a huge part of that is because of the Olympics and the competition for that. Now, I don't know. LeVar has not commented on this whole mess at all. You know, all the journalists were going to him, going to his rep, asking, well, what does this mean? Like, would you even consider being host now? And he's stayed silent so far. So it's unclear to me whether he still wants it after all this. Mm.
You know, I wouldn't even be doing this show today if it weren't for the mess, for the controversy, because, you know, I like Jeopardy and, you know, I've watched it for years, but it is what it is. I guess the conflict is what makes this all kind of interesting and newsworthy. But I'm wondering, has all the uncertainty and all of this cost the show in any way?
I think fans think so. I mean, you know, we're not sure on the ratings aspect. We'll see with Mike Richards' performance Monday through Friday this week. I've spoken to fans who do feel like the show has lost something in all of this, has lost this sense of, you know, being above politics, being above controversy. My take is, you know, this is 2021. I'm not sure anything is above politics and controversy anymore. So I think people just need to give that idea up in a sense. But you know, I know a lot of people who are going to be eager to tune in to whoever the next host is. So we'll just have to see how the ratings turn out in the next month.
Number three all-time Jeopardy champ and Ohio State grad, must be noted, Matt Amodio, resumes his championship run today. How do winning streaks boost ratings? I know they used to fix the games back in the 50s, you know, to either create a running streak or to stop one. And we're going to talk about that later. But what is it about running streaks? Winning streaks,
yeah,
I mean.
Right. I think a good example of how much winning streaks affect interest is that, you know, the New York Times had not really covered Jeopardy very much until James Holzhauer really wowed everyone with his performance. I mean, he just again and again became the person who ranked highest in terms of amount of money won in a game. And so we started covering that pretty aggressively because there was just so much interest in it. I mean, people are just enchanted by the magic of someone on stage, clearly have incredible intelligence and are just answering these questions rapid fire correctly. And so with James Holzhauer, you had this, I think, an increasing fan base. They, you know, the network really capitalized on that by then putting him in a greatest of all time tournament with Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings, which Ken Jennings ended up winning. So it's clear that when people are really good, that is a good thing for Jeopardy ratings.
And just to let our listeners know, Richard Cordray, Ohio politician, first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, five-time Jeopardy champion in 1987 and a Tournament of Champions semifinalist. He's now chief operating officer of the Federal Student Aid for the U.S. Department of Education. He's going to join us later on in the program to tell us about his experience on Jeopardy. If you've been on a game show before, listeners, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd love to hear your quick stories about your experience. And Julia Jacobs, thanks so much for helping us kick this off. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
Julia Jacobs is an arts and culture reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, we're going to talk to an historian who's written books about this topic. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the game show universe, Jeopardy ranks among the all-time greats, in part for turning the answer into the question. Its eventual popularity, though, was a function of those that went before, including the show 21. In this clip from 1956, 21 game show host Jack Barry explains to the audience the high-stakes face-off between contestants Charles Van Doren and Herbert Stempel.
If either player stops the game right now, Mr. Van Doren, who is 8 points ahead at $2,500 a point, will win back $20,000 from Herb Stempel. But he doesn't know it because they don't know each other's scores. Let's see what happens.
Turns out, they really did know each other's scores. Adam Niedef is the author of 9 books on the history of American game shows, including the 2018 title Game Show FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Pioneers, the Scandals, the Hosts, and the Jackpots. He's also involved in the production of game shows as a question researcher for shows including College Bowl, Double Dare, Masterminds, and NBC's upcoming The Wheel. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
21 was one of those game shows that was rigged. How did the cheating scandals come to light? Because they played it very close to the vest.
They were very, very clever about it. And as you said, played it close to the vest. To contextualize, what people don't understand now is the amount of control that sponsors had over television programming in the 1950s. And you even see it in the title of some shows. That's why shows were called the U.S. Steel Hour or General Electric Theater. Sponsors had control over the shows and their content. And sponsors wanted good, exciting, engaging shows, however you had to deliver that. 21, for example, delivered a very bad first episode because they played it legitimately for the first night that they were on the air. And the sponsor, Geritol, a division of Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, told them, we don't want to see a show that bad ever again. So the decision was made to rig the show at that point. A number of the game shows had different measures that they could take. Like, for example, the $64,000 question would just have the contestants take a test before each broadcast to get a read on what the contestants were knowledgeable in. And then if you wanted a contestant to do well, you would only ask them what they knew. 21, because it was one player versus one player, you had to script the entire thing. Because if you only script one person, then there's a chance that the other person is going to be so smart they're going to overcome the scripting. So every move and every correct answer of 21 was fully orchestrated. And what gave it away eventually was not anything that happened on 21. It was actually something that happened on an unrelated show, a show on CBS called Dotto, which was also a one versus one show. A contestant named Marie Wen was going to be on the show. She was keeping to herself backstage and looking at a notebook, and a standby contestant named Edward Hilgemeyer asked what she had in her notebook, and she said, oh, I'm taking a test for college. I'm studying for a test. Oh, okay. So she sets the notebook aside when she's going on stage to play her game, and Edward Hilgemeyer, suddenly feeling a little bit nosy, grabs the notebook and starts thumbing through it while she's playing the game. And he realizes every answer to every question she's getting is in this notebook. So he took that down to the police. He actually went to the police while the show was still on the air and just dropped off the notebook and said, this is happening right this second. And as it turned out, Herb Stempel, one of the contestants in the clip that you just played, had already gone to the authorities and was trying to rat them out about 21. And nobody was listening to him because the assumption was that he was just a sore loser. So once this happened on Dotto, everybody suddenly took another look at Herb Stempel and said, maybe there's something to what this guy said.
But, you know, none of this was illegal.
That's the crazy part about this. Yeah. It hadn't occurred to anybody yet that you would rig a game show or that you would want to. And that's why the House Oversight Committee ended up having these hearings about game shows, because they suddenly realized, oh, wow, we should probably have some laws regulating this. And I can tell you, as somebody who works in game show production now, yes, there are absolutely laws regulating this. You're pulled aside and warned about it in a meeting at the start of every production of every show.
Really?
And there are measures all the way through everything we do to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again.
Interesting. I mean, because people gamble on these things, right? I mean, there's people out there betting.
Oh, yeah. There are, which is wild
to me. People bet about anything. Yeah.
And, you know, it's one thing to, you know, say, well, you know, what does it matter? It's just a game show. It is just a game show, but the thing is, these are real people. These are people that we've pulled into our world for our benefit to get a good rating and deliver, we think, we hope, a good show. And we want to give them some respect and make sure that nothing untoward happens to them or that they're not dragged through anything that they don't deserve to be a part of.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about game show history, a la, you know, the controversy surrounding Jeopardy. My guest is Adam Nedef. He is the author of 9 books on the history of American game shows, including the 2018 book Game Show FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Pioneers, the Scandals, the Hosts, and the Jackpots. Love to hear from people who have been contestants on game shows. Love to hear about your experience. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Betsy in St. Louis, you're on the air. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So I see here you've been on the Family Feud.
We were on the Family Feud in, I think, 83. I was in college, and my sisters were also in college. My oldest sister couldn't come to the tryout, so she couldn't be on it. But Richard Dawson kissed everybody at the time, all the females, and they checked our lips with a magnifying glass before we kissed him. And my sister, looking back, it sounds super creepy, but at the time it was normal. But my sister had a little scar on her lip from a skating accident, and so he wouldn't kiss her.
So they actually took a magnifying glass to your lips.
Oh, they had a person in charge of the magnifying glass. It was all very organized, and it wasn't just a cursory glance. It was an inspection. So,
and how did you do on the game show, by the way? How'd your family do?
We won, actually. $10,000 was the big jackpot at the time. I don't know what it is now, but we won, and then we had a great time that night. My dad was really excited that we had won money, and he had 4 girls in college. So.
Well, Betsy, thanks a lot for calling in and telling us.
Okay, thanks, Dan.
See ya.
Wow. Wow. I actually, I know Richard's daughter-in-law, who was the producer of the show at the time, and I'm going to run that by her.
Oh, my gosh.
Now I'm curious about this, and I want to know for myself.
You know, I should have asked her if they made them wipe their lips off or anything, too, you know, with a disinfectant.
Yeah.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Obviously, that was to protect the sanctity of Richard Dawson's lips, I guess.
Of course, yes.
But how much control do the hosts have in the world of game shows? Does it depend?
It really does depend. Some hosts are also the producers of the shows, so there's a level of control there. But generally speaking, the host is removed from as much of the process as possible to make things fair. Like, the host has no control over who the contestants are.
Okay.
The host generally doesn't have control over the game material. They'll be given the material in advance to study it, but they don't generally have control over what it is, although they can make suggestions and make contributions. Alex Trebek certainly did. So it varies from show to show, but generally speaking, the host is just the host, and that's the way that many shows prefer it, just for that level of security, to keep as many people from interlocking and having too much control over one portion of the show as possible.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Give us a call if you've been on a game show. We'd love to hear your stories. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Ann. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I was on actually 2 game shows. I was on the $50,000 Pyramid back in the early 80s with Dick Clark. Yeah, and some of the contestants, or the celebs, are Soupy Sales and Joanne Worley and a bunch of others. That was a lot of fun. And then just about 2 years ago, I was on The Price is Right.
So is this something that you really worked hard? Did you have to work hard to get on the shows?
Well, the first one, it was a little bit of a process. I went down to New York City. That's where they were filming at the time. And they went through, you know, kind of, you watched a show. And then if you wanted to apply for the show, you kind of filled out a form and went through a process and they called me back the next day or a week later and said, okay, you made it through the first round. Then you go to the second round. And then we got a phone call and said, okay, you're on. And then we had to come back down another, you know, maybe a week later. And that's when they filmed it. And I ended up, it was a tournament of champion thing, and went from 10 of us to three of us. And then I didn't win it, but the gal from New Jersey won $50,000. So, and then it was kind of interesting, a guy that was, so the girl won, I came in third, I guess. And then the other guy, went on to Jeopardy. He ended up being a Jeopardy champion, Tournament of Champions winner years later.
was that Bob Verini? Do you remember the
name?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Bob Verini.
Yeah. Fantastic champion. Yeah, I believe I've seen the tournament that you were on. And Bob Verini stood out to me because I recognized him from Jeopardy also. But yeah, so I've absolutely seen the game of Pyramid that you played.
So Bob,
that's the one. It was a lot of fun. Won a lot of Rice-A-Roni and turtle wax back then.
Fantastic.
And let me just ask you this real quick, Bob. Was it fun?
Oh my gosh, are you kidding? It was a blast. It was so much fun. And then the complete opposite with The Price is Right. My wife and I just were going to California, and I said the night before, I said, "You want to go watch the show?" And she said, "Sure." And we got shirts made, and then we got in line, we waited. You get interviewed for about, they interview every single person in the audience.
Wow.
To see if you can, you know, if you want to do it. And then we sat down, and within 5 seconds, I was the second name called. I went up there, won the, got up on stage, won my prize, spun the wheel, won the wheel, went to the showcase, and then overbid.
Yeah, it can happen fast. That's a sudden death, right?
What time did you show up at the studio for The Price is Right? Do you remember what time you got there?
It was early. I mean, we flew in at around 7 in the morning. I think we got in line at maybe 10, and then there was probably 4 hours in line, and then another hour or so in the staging area.
Wow.
And then the filming. I mean, it was a full day, but hey, I won a lot of stuff, and we had a blast. Are you kidding?
I came out to Los Angeles as a tourist before I moved here, and I saw a taping when Bob Barker was still the host, and we were advised, you want to come early. And how early are you talking? They said, really, the night before. So we got there with lawn chairs at 11 p.m. and there were already about 100 people in line ahead of us for the next day's taping of The Price is Right.
That's crazy. Bob, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. But anybody else, we'd love to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest, Adam Neideff, is the author of 9 books on the history of American game shows. Adam, you know, you just mentioned Bob Barker, which is what I kind of grew up with. And I just loved Bob Barker. I mean, what's the sense? I mean, do you get the sense that it's the same sort of chemistry they're shooting for today as, you know, 100 years ago when I was watching Bob Barker?
I mean, there's a lot of things they're looking for a host, and kind of the magic of Bob Barker, I think, was not so much what he did, but what he brought out of the contestants. Bob once said that there was a fan letter that he kept because it sort of drove home what it was that he did and that he did well. He got a fan letter from a woman who had been a contestant on The Price is Right. And she said, "I don't know what got into me, but I've never been as funny as I was the day that I was on that show." And Bob said, well, the reason was that there was some sort of potential for humor in her. And as a host, the idea is to extract it and bring something out of them that they normally wouldn't bring out. So that's what a good MC does. As far as chemistry, now, do you mean the chemistry between the host and the show, or the host between the contestants? What do you mean by chemistry?
Well, I mean, I guess what Bob Barker did was very different than what, say, an Alex Trebek did. I mean, Alex had to interact. He didn't interact with the audience. He interacted with very carefully selected guests. I mean,
every game show calls for something different from the hosts and even from show to show. And that's a point that I had to make when Alex passed away. I would get a lot of questions about what Alex brought to the show as an MC, or what he brought in general. A good MC is versatile, and Alex didn't get credit for versatility. The magic of YouTube is you can go back and you can look at other shows now that you can see that Alex had hosted over the years. And what you come to recognize was that Alex turned in a very different performance on all the game shows he hosted over the years. If you get a chance to watch High Rollers, that's a different Alex Trebek than you see hosting Jeopardy. Not just different because he has a massive afro and a bushy mustache when he's hosting High Rollers, but also just he is very laid back. He has one one hand on the steering wheel through the whole show, cracks jokes between the questions, plays around with the contestants, because High Rollers was this very light quiz show with very easy questions, and the contestants rolled a giant pair of dice to win the game. And, you know, you can't give a game like that gravitas, so Alex didn't try. That's not what he was there for. On the other hand, there's Jeopardy, which is America's nightly IQ test, and it already had this reputation that Art Fleming and his incarnation of Jeopardy had given it. So Alex treated it with a seriousness and a straightforwardness because he felt that that's what Jeopardy deserved. So what a host needs to do is recognize what this show is, what the show is trying to be, and deliver the performance that that show calls for. Not every show calls for the same performance.
Let's see. Is it Lucia or Lusha?
Lucia.
Lucia in Columbus. Hi, Lucia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Long time listener.
Thank you.
So I just thought I would call in and share. I was on Jeopardy a number of years back. So long ago that I did not receive cash as a prize. I got fabulous parting gifts, no turtle wax, but no cash prizes. And funny moment was some viewers might not know that everything is taped in real time. So
yeah.
Before heading into Final Jeopardy, it was shown to us what the prizes would be. And the second place prize was going to be a trip to Austria. And the guy who was ahead of me, points-wise, said, oh, I'll take that. And so he ended up getting that, and I ended up in third place. my goose was kind of cooked when I got a daily double wrong and couldn't catch up. But it was a great experience, a lot of fun, even though I was super nervous when that red light came on the camera. I was on the Friday show of the week. Jeopardy always tapes a whole week and a day. Mm-hmm. And so I got to be in the audience for four shows, which was both fun and super nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Watching the other contestants who I'd met that morning. And but being in the audience, I got to see when Alex came out and took questions from the audience. That was an experience. He had a very snarky sense of humor.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't think people always realize. I think some people, especially now, you know, as wonderful as he was, I think people sometimes venerate him like he was a saint, but he was really snarky too.
Lucia, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to take one more call before you go, we lose you, Adam Needoff, sure. And I want to talk to you a little bit more. But Tim in Lancaster, you're on the air.
Hello? Is this Ann?
Yeah.
Hi, Ann. It's good to talk to you. I was on our high school took a trip, our percussion ensemble took a trip to Orenburg, Russia in 1995. And it was quite an experience. And we got to go on a game show, my mom and dad and me. It was called Dom, and it's in Orenburg. And so we appeared on national Russian TV.
How did do that? I mean,
it was amazing. Our liaison had hooked it up and coordinated it. Her name was Larissa. And we had a blast. They had to translate everything for us.
Yeah.
And we had some experiences such as they give you a lot of ingredients and you make it's family versus family. And so we had to make a sandwich for them to eat and they had to make a sandwich for us to eat. And they piled a lot of mayonnaise on that. And my dad hates mayonnaise, but he had to eat the sandwich. And then just great experiences. The final winning event was darts. And so I threw darts to win. And so we sort of, I guess, won for the American side.
That is something. Have you ever heard of that before, Adam Needoff?
I mean, I have friends who have been on shows in Great Britain, but I mean, that's an English speaking country, so that's not so shocking. There was a Saturday Night Live skit where Chris Farley ends up being on a game show in Japan. I've never heard of that actually happening in real life to somebody getting roped into a show in a foreign language realm. That's a great story.
Yeah, that is something. I'm thinking about a plot for a movie or something. So before I let you go, Adam, I just wondered what your thoughts are about the enduring popularity of these shows. They still run the gamut. You know, they still are from the ridiculous to the erudite.
Yeah, the enduring popularity. First of all, there's the fact that they're cost effective and that they get good ratings. Okay. As long as game shows remain cheap to produce, and as long as they attract an audience, we're always going to have game shows. And game shows are deceptively inexpensive, despite the big prize jackpots that are given away. They really do not cost nearly as much as any one scripted episode of a drama or a sitcom.
Gotcha.
Also, there's the vicarious nature of the feelings that you get when you tune in as a viewer. You're thinking about how well you would do. When you're watching Jeopardy, you're comparing yourselves to these players and thinking, oh, I would have gotten that, or oh, I could have beaten these people, or oh, I don't
never
know how I could handle this. Yeah. There's the chance to see that, and there's also the chance to kind of fantasize about, wow, what would I do with this $1 million if the contestant has a chance to go for? So that's the appeal of game shows, and there's a lot of other factors. I know as a small child, I was attracted to game shows because of the bright lights and colors. So there's things that attract game shows through all audiences for all reasons, but they endure, and I'm glad that they do because I've made a nice living off them so far.
Well, it's been a lot of fun to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Adam Nedef. He is author of 9 books on the history of American game shows, including the 2018 volume Game Show FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Pioneers, the Scandals, the Hosts, and the Jackpots. We have more to come, including Richard Cordray, Ohio politician, first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, now chief operating officer of the Federal Student Aid for the U.S. Department of Education, and a 5-time Jeopardy champion in 1987. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Jeopardy! Begins its 38th season tonight, September 13th, still without a permanent host for the first time in 37 years. The public audition process generated criticism and controversy. One bright spot has been contestant Matt Amodio. He's an Ohio native and Ohio State grad. He's on a hot winning streak. He's now the third winningest Jeopardy champion of all time. Richard Cordray can kind of relate to that. The Ohio politician and the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was a 5-time Jeopardy champion in 1987 and a Tournament of Champions semifinalist. He's now chief operating officer of Federal Student Aid for the U.S. Department of Education. Welcome, Rich Cordray.
Pleasure to be with you, Ann.
So when you were on Jeopardy, champions were limited to 5 wins. What do you make of the championship runs of the likes of Ken Jennings, James Holzhauer, the current champ, Matt Amodio?
Well, those of us who were term limited, to adopt the political term, always feel we would have won a lot of games ourselves. Although when I see some of the champions who've gone on for a long string, and of course, Ken Jennings was unique, but Matt is pretty great, and some of these others. You know, they're facing tough competition. I was in the early days of Jeopardy. I think the competition even to get on the show today is much harder because there's application process that's remote. So many, many more people are trying to get on Jeopardy. And I just think it's really impressive when somebody puts together a string of wins against what is always 2 other tough competitive players.
We were talking with, I think Lucia, her name was, and she called and said it was very nerve-wracking at first. She sat through four episodes that they were recording before she got on. What was it like for you? Were you ever nervous?
Sure. And I think what happens is they bring in 15 contestants, and they do a week's worth of shows in one day, so 5 shows in a day. And you don't know when you're going to get a chance, and you don't know who you're going to be up against. But when you do get your name called, you know that there's somebody who's a defending champion, and they've just looked like a world beater. I mean, you know, typically.
Yeah.
It's pretty intimidating. And then you come on, and you're nervous, I think, until you win a game. then you feel like you haven't been a failure. And you know, think about it. Most people who try to get on Jeopardy, and sometimes they spend years getting on Jeopardy, and then two out of three of them lose. So, you know, it's a tough experience, I think, but it's a real a feather in your cap even to get on the show. But if you win, then you feel really good. Plus, you come home with some money.
Right, exactly. How long did the process last for you to be a champion? Five-time Jeopardy champion in 1987. So that lasts how many days?
Well, let me try to think about, I went out to, at that time, they didn't have remote. So you had to go out to Los Angeles if you wanted to try out. So okay. You had to fly out there at your own expense to take a crack at it, which I did. I think that was in September. And then I got a call back from them in November saying that I would be out for taping in January. So I actually had about 6 weeks of knowing I was going to be on the show, and then you can try to study. Of course, studying the world's knowledge is a bit of a fool's errand. On the other hand, you know a lot of things. It's just a matter of bringing them up to the top of your brain, a lot of facts and names and dates. So, you know, I tried to do that. And also work on your quick recall, but you know, you can only do so much with that too. And then I was my shows were taped in January. They showed in the spring, and then I was in the Tournament of Champions later that fall as well. And then I was called back to a Jeopardy 30, you know, greatest of the greatest players of all time, not the 30 greatest, but 30 of the greatest, a few years ago, and that was. That was out in Los Angeles as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're part of a distinguished alumni group, I, for lack of a better term. I mean, what is it like? Do you stay in touch with people? Is it a club?
You know, I did for a while with the people that I played with, particularly in the Tournament of Champions, I would say that I haven't particularly kept up with them since. I do get calls now and again from people who are going to be on, who, you know, somehow get my number and want to talk about preparing for it or thoughts that you have. And, you know, there's only a limited amount of things you can say to them. There's also some books out there now that have been written by former Jeopardy champions that are pretty good. They have a lot of questions in them because you have to fill a book, and it's hard to fill an entire book with just your experience in Jeopardy for a few days. Anyway, those are pretty good. And if you look at those, you can find some insights in those to make you a better player.
You know, the game has changed. We heard that at the beginning, there weren't cash prizes. Now, you know, it was like the Rice-A-Roni kind of a thing or whatever. But they've changed the game in other ways too, going for the $1,000 category right off the bat, for example, and more often making daily doubles, true high stakes double or nothing. What are your thoughts about how they've changed the game? Do you like it?
Well, they haven't changed the game other than, as you say, in terms of prize money.
Yeah.
They've only stuck to one strong principle, which is only the winner of the game gets to keep what they earn. And everybody else gets, as you say, to begin with, the second and third place winners got prizes rather than money. And now they give them money, but it's not much. It's like, I think, $2,000 and $1,000. So they're trying to preserve the notion that you really want to play to win. Because if you win, you get the big jackpot. And if you don't, you don't get a big jackpot. If people could keep their $9,000, they might not bet to win. You know, they'd have that concern. In terms of the rest of it, it's the players who have changed the game. There are players who have, I mean, I was a different player when I was on, because one of the things I did was I would skip around the board, which was unusual at that time. Typically, people started at the top of the category and they went to the bottom of that category. Then they went to another category. It was like you watch people eating, and sometimes they will clean their plate by eating all of their peas first and then all of their potatoes and all of their meat. That was sort of the way people thought to do it originally. And I was skipping around the board, and it gives you an advantage because you know where you're looking and the others have to then find the category. It gives you about a second advantage on them in terms of thinking about what the question is. But people have been now starting at the bottom and then working up to the top. which means that they clear out all the high value questions first. So if they have a lead, it's harder to catch up to them. And they're hunting for the daily doubles, especially trying to get those out of the way and get them for themselves. So there's a certain amount of, I mean, it's a limited amount of strategy for a game like that, but there's a certain amount of strategy that has evolved over time, and players have gotten more creative about thinking about how to approach the board of 60 questions, 30 in the first round, 30 in the second round, and then, of course, the final Jeopardy.
You know, when I first met you back in 89 or 90, when I was covering the Ohio General Assembly, you were a member in the House. Basically, people would say, oh, that's the guy that was on Jeopardy, you know, kind of to define you at that time. And it's still a thing. I mean, it's still a big deal that you were on Jeopardy to a lot of people. Tell me, you know, any particular impact on your life, any particular long-term thread for you?
Well, I do think, frankly, this is all because of Alex Trebek. He made that game a success. He made it a sort of nightly ritual in many homes around the country. And so if you're part of the culture of Jeopardy, if you will, it gives you some prominence. It's a thing. In fact, all the things that people would see on my resume, I think the thing that always sticks out the most to them is that I was on Jeopardy. They can relate to that, and it's fun, you know, as opposed to this job or that job, which kind of, you know, doesn't necessarily impress people as much. But I will say that, as you say, that was a lot of years ago, and at the time, it was not at all clear that Jeopardy would have the staying power that it did. I mean, here you are talking to me about it today, and it was 30 years ago that I was on the show.
Right.
So, you know, again, I give all the credit on that to Alex Trebek. He was a familiar figure, became a beloved figure in people's homes every night, which, you know, you do a regular show here. It is not easy to do. Now, Jeopardy has a formula. It's a lot easier than what you do, which is coming up with new topics every time and being prepared to talk about very different things. And I give you a lot of credit, Anne. It's a tough gig. you make it look easy. Anyway, Alex was somebody who really developed a following. And so everybody associated with him and everybody that he, you know, lauded as this champion or that champion, I think got a little bit of the reflected glow from his tremendously warm and well-liked personality.
So what do you think about the process for picking the successor? And anybody...
It's been a disaster, frankly. And, you know, you see this sometimes with appointments to political office or corporate successions in the business field. Sometimes they get it just right. Sometimes there's an obvious successor, and sometimes it's an easy choice. Sometimes they go through a prolonged, it becomes more and more agonizing as you go process. And it gets bungled, and Jeopardy has been badly bungled here. It seems, looking from the outside, I don't have inside scoop on this, but they kind of had in mind the insider, Mike Richards, and his way was kind of greased, but they were trying to create an appearance of a competition and make that into something that would get attention, which it did get attention. I think there were a lot of interesting hosts who were never going to do the long-term gig, but were there for celebrity value. And then it turned out that they didn't do the vetting very well. And you see this again, I've seen it for political offices where people end up not end up being nominated, even though they were going to be, or not being confirmed if they're nominated. And that's sort of what you have with Jeopardy. And as the last report, they're still looking.
Exactly. Well, Rich Cordray, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you joining the show.
Sure, very fun to talk about this with you.
It's good to see you. That's Richard Cordray. He's a lawyer, public official, undefeated five-time Jeopardy champion. From 2012 till 2017, he was the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He now serves as chief operating officer of federal student aid for the U.S. Department of Education. That's it. Thanks for the great calls today, and thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.